Hi, okay, so I'm Stacey Cooper. As you know, this work was done along with our program manager, Dr. Ali Hamade, and also with Rachel Worley, who works at ATSDR. So this presentation in general is just going to be about a comparison of two lead exposure models for the evaluation of a project that we did up in Fairbanks, Alaska. So here's an outline of my talk. I'm going to give a little bit of a background on this whole project, and then I'll talk about the integrated exposure uptake biokinetics model, the IUBK model from EPA, and I'll also talk about the all-ages lead model and the application of these models to lead exposure from soil, which is what this project was about. And I'll talk about the model parameters that we used, the results that we got, and then how we move forward from what we have. So a little bit of background. The evaluation of lead exposure from contaminated sites is a frequent project for us in public health in our program, and I know in programs around the country. Currently, there are kind of what I know of two mainly used models for children. There's the EPA's IEUBK model, and for adults, the EPA's adult lead model. And these models have some limitations that I'll talk about later. And basically, because of these limitations, we could really use some new methods to assess these projects. So the IEUBK model, it's a model created by the EPA. It's been around in some form or another since the late 80s, early 90s, and it's kind of been continually improved since then. Right now, it consists of four interrelated modules to estimate blood lead levels in children. And so these modules include exposure and uptake, biokinetic module, and a probability distribution component. And there are parameters that the user can adjust, and these include the air concentration in lead, or the lead concentration in air, the lead concentration in diet, in the soil and dust, the lead concentration in water, and the maternal blood lead level when a child is born, and also the bioavailability can be adjusted in this model. So some of the model limitations in the IEUBK model, you can only assess children up to 7 years old. It can't be used for short-term or intermittent exposures. The model assumes a stable lead exposure over the course of a whole year, or if you're looking at ingestion, you need ideally 3 months worth of 1 day per week for a meal that includes lead as part of the balanced diet. And so short-term and intermittent exposures don't really work with IEUBK. And also, you can't account for seasonal variability in exposure. So up here in Alaska, that's an issue because particularly in the project that we were looking at, there's snow cover in some parts of the state for 6 months of the year. So enter the all-ages lead model. It's been under development by the EPA since 1999. And the latest effort was started in 2013 with the assistance from ATSDR. So that's where Rachel Worley has come in. She's kind of helping to develop this model for ATSDR. And I should mention, unfortunately, she couldn't make it to the conference, which is sad for me. But she's a treasure trove of knowledge in this. The AALM model, it's a multi-compartment biokinetic model that's designed to predict lead concentrations in blood, bone, and brain. It can also predict the lead concentration in excretions as well. And the great thing about this model is it can assess lead risk for any age under any exposure scenario. So that's great in terms of its flexibility. It can do intermittent exposures. It can do a single exposure. It can do long-term exposures. It's really fantastic for that. Unfortunately, the AALM model is not yet available for use. It's under development, and ATSDR was kind enough to take some of our data and run it through their model so that we could kind of compare the results to the IUBK model. But unfortunately, we can't put that in our health consultations. You can't use it for regulatory purposes because the model is still under development by EPA. And also, the model does a good job at higher lead concentrations, but it's still being validated for lower concentrations of lead exposure. So here's our project. It's the Aurora coal-fired power plant up in Fairbanks. That's a photo of it to the right. It's along the Chena River. And close to the power plant are some homes that have varying amounts of lead in their soil. And so we analyzed lead levels that people were exposed to from the soil at these homes with both the IUBK model and Rachel ran our data through the ALM model for us. So the model parameters that we used for IUBK were the default parameters for that model, and these are shown here. And these are just national averages. The model parameters we use for AALM, we use the IUBK default for air, water, the maternal blood lead levels, and the dust concentrations. But also for the AALM, we were able to actually use seasonality. So we were able to turn off lead exposure from the soil for 6 months of the year when there was snow cover. So that was really great. And for bioavailability, we ran the models, we ran the ALM model twice. For one run, we used the IEUBK bioavailability defaults, and for one run, we used the AALM bioavailability defaults. So this is just a table that shows the differences between the two models for the percent bioavailable lead. You can see in the left-hand column is IUBK in general, or for all the parameters, it's a lower percentage of bioavailable lead for the default and than the AALM. But what's important to note is that the IUBK uses absolute bioavailability and AALM uses relative bioavailability. So these are a little bit of different animals, and so it's a little bit hard to compare. But anyway, these are the numbers, and it's just good to know moving forward. So this is the comparison given those different numbers in bioavailability. This just goes to show that the ideal scenario would be to have a site-specific bioavailability number if it's possible, but you can see the in red is the IUBK defaults used, which were the lower ones, and in blue is the ALM bioavailability. So IUBK came out lower in general for the blood lead concentrations in children with those lower bioavailability numbers, and ALM came out with higher results. So here is kind of the results of our model output comparison. So we ran the numbers for two different residences. There were 8 residences in this neighborhood, and resident 7 had a fairly high concentration of lead in their soil at 311 parts per million, and resident 8 had a lower concentration of almost 21 parts per million. And for the IUBK model, the geometric mean blood lead level came out to 3.7 micrograms per deciliter for the children, and compared to ALM, which is a little bit lower, at 2.5 micrograms per deciliter. And so for residents 8 with a lower concentration of lead in the soil, the numbers were a little bit more similar, 1 versus 0.8. And it's worth noting that for these runs, for the IUBK, we used the defaults for that model, and for both models, we used the residential soil lead levels. We were able to adjust that. And for the ALM model, we were able to use the seasonality, so turned off the soil exposure for 6 months of the year, and that resulted in, not surprisingly, lower predicted blood lead concentrations in the children. So this is kind of the crux of our lives in dealing with lead exposure and trying to predict the risk involved. ALM looks like it could be a good model in the future, but we can't use the results officially yet. We can't put them in documents. We can't use them for regulatory purposes. And we don't know when the model is going to be finished. And there really isn't any predictions on that. EPA is developing it, and they're running it and tweaking it, but people don't know when it'll be finished. And until it's finished, we can't use it. So until then, we have the IUBK model, and we don't currently have a tool for intermittent or short-term or single exposures. So that's a bit problematic for us. And, you know, we're always wondering about the health effects of transient versus persistent lead exposure. And it's a big question for us. And so we are just kind of wondering, well, what's the best thing to do? What do we do from here? And if any of you in the crowd have more experience in this than we do, we are absolutely interested in hearing about it. And that's all I have. So if any of you have any questions or ideas, please let us know. Or what was the second part? Brownfields. Well, you can, if you know if there's any air quality monitoring in whatever area that you're interested in, then you can adjust the lead concentration in air. And so that's kind of all that you can do. Is that kind of what you were thinking about? That would be great. Thanks.
Yeah.
You know, we offered blood lead testing to the residents. There were two homes that had elevated lead concentrations in their soil, and we offered free testing to them, and they declined. So so no, we don't have any data for that. That would be a great idea to know kind of how well the models did, but I think they didn't want government in their health. So
hi, Stacy, thanks for another great presentation. I have a question. Given one of the issues at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks was the unreliability of their heat system and their electricity system. So they decided they got an appropriation for several hundred million dollars to build a fluidized bed, coal-fired facility on campus to meet all of their energy needs. And I was wondering whether...
Which campus did you say?
University of Alaska, Fairbanks.
Fairbanks, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So it's their new power plant is going to be coal, which is kind of ironic in Alaska, that we're picking new energy sources and that we're complaining about relocating communities and we need all of this federal help. But I wondered if you knew, and we also heard that we have some atmospheric effects of air pollution that comes from China and all of the power plants that they've built there, that even that affects there's transport of it that's kind of to our region. And I just wondered if the fluidized bed, that technology, significantly reduced emissions of lead, or if lead in power plant production is a relatively minor issue compared to lead that comes from other sources like lead paint or gasoline or all of those kinds of things. So it's just a context question of whether or not we have an issue with energy sources and lead, or whether the real issue is more ash or electrostatic precipitators and stuff that's the air pollution equipment.
Well, you know, we don't know for sure that this lead contamination is necessarily from the coal-fired power plant. We just know that it's there, and there happens to be a coal-fired power plant next door, and that's about kind of what we know.
Okay.
So I am not familiar with the technology that you're talking about. I have to admit, I don't personally know a lot about coal-fired power plant emissions in terms of, you know, whether the fluid?
Oh, it's a fluidized bed coal, which is a way that influences the amount of emissions that come out of it because of the way the coal is treated. There's other technologies like coal liquefaction and coal gasification. But I think all of this is evolving with the president's clean power plan, and which is, it says coal isn't our first choice. We want all of the above. But
right.
And so renewables, obviously, I'd be really surprised if wind generators were emitting a lot of lead or something, but you just never know what's next on the horizon. So I was just kind of curious about, since you mentioned the problem with persistent exposures or transient exposures, and I have a son that works in an interstate battery plant, and he says, oh, Dad, it's no problem because they measure our blood lead levels all the time, and they say the OSHA standard is protected, but we have our standard that's half that. And but it's a persistent exposure that he's going to be exposed to all the time. And I used to work up in Cincinnati, and there's a Kettering Research Lab there. And they're famous for all of their work on lead and the nuclear weapons complex. So I'm just trying to get a little better handle on understanding, you know.
Yeah, I personally don't know if anybody here in the audience knows, anybody out there know about coal-fired emissions with lead? Okay.
Yeah, maybe a relatively minor concern.
I mean, I can tell you that here in Alaska, when we are calling people with elevated blood lead levels and kind of like what Megan does, we have yet to kind of call someone because they're living next to a coal-fired power plant. You know, more often it's some kind of other exposure, whether it be old paint or we have this really, this everything under the sun, you know, a toy that contains lead, or a kid being around an airplane that was painted with lead paint. There's kind of more sort of random sources than, there's not a lot of coal-fired power plants up here, so it's not like a major source for elevated blood lead levels here in Alaska.
Thanks.
Sure. Great, thanks.